Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Good afternoon, Internet Radio. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Kim. We're the directors of Food Book Fair, an annual festival and events around the calendar year in New York City, mostly all about writing about eating, where we celebrate independent magazines, books, of course, TV, radio, the finest of food media, and the most provocative. And we're on your airwaves every week, Tuesdays at 2 p.m., talking about what we're reading, watching, and listening to in and around the world of food, along with our friends and family in and around the world of food.
We are going to get into what Kim and I are watching, reading, or listening to in a moment, but just to make sure everyone knows to keep those radios dial, that radio dial on, it's because we have one of our biggest supporters and friends of Food Book Fair with us in the studio today, Joshua David Stein, a man who has three names. We'll get into that a little bit when we talk to him. He is one of the most prolific food and culture writers out there. If you ever check his Instagram, he posts something new every day, and we're going to talk to him about everything, when he writes, how he writes, all of that. And so we'll be back with Joshua after we take a break. But first, we are going to talk about what we're watching, reading, or listening to. And I am just getting back into Insecure. I don't know if anyone else out there is a fan of this show, but I was counting down the days until it came back. And I just watched the beginning of season two. And first thing is, it made me a little, it makes me have this little twinge of like, should I move to LA? Like, they make LA look so good and fun. And I'm super in love with New York, but it's really nice to see kind of like after Master of None and Girls and some more New York centric shows that I watched a lot. I love seeing shows in LA. Kim, did you watch season one, Kim?
I have not seen it. Okay. I'm sort of on a prolonged TV on my computer break and don't know how to get back into it. Also, you've never given me your HBO Go password, which we've talked about many times.
I think I'll just give it out to everyone right now so they can watch it. Anyway, I loved it. Getting back into it, I will say that the end of season one was one of like the most heart-wrenching kind of cliffhangers, and they really left you like with like a pit in your stomach. It was kind of the breakdown of a romance. But the one thing that was fun about this most recent episode that I watched was they had something called a wine down. W-I-N-E, and then down.
As in, like, dance hall, wine in?
No. It was like a party, and they call it a wine down. Like, they have it on Friday
with wine.
Night. With wine.
Okay.
They reference, like, Carlo Rossi.
Okay.
In this episode. Like, kind of more, a little inexpensive wine. Everyone brings one. It can be, you know, it could be... The show is centered around two female characters, but oftentimes their get-togethers are co-ed, I'll say. So it could either be co-ed or just ladies, and it's just like they just drink some wine and talk about their week, and it was you could tell the way that they refer to it was like one of their most favorite things to do. So I think I'm inspired to host my own wine down.
You should.
Yeah.
Please invite me.
Think about it.
I'll bring the Carlo Rossi jug.
That's I think that's what they had.
I've bought the jug once or twice.
Where?
It's been a while.
Is the jug still sold in stores? The
jug is still sold in stores.
Okay.
The last time might have been like in 2007 with a fake ID in like Ann Arbor, Michigan, though, so I can't tell you. Like,
well,
what's the latest?
All right.
On jug sales.
If anyone out there sees a lot of Carlo Rossi jugs out there, just tell us where they're at. We will go and buy one. I feel like we need it to do research at this
point.
Just
keep it in the booth.
Yeah, I know David would probably like that. He would really love a jug of wine, so we need to get one for him. Well, Kim, what have you been reading, watching, or listening to these days?
I've mostly been listening to a lot of Top 40 and rap, which I think I've talked about on the show before. Part of my summer self-care program, which I think I've also talked about as I've been traveling and house sitting and sort of jumping around a lot, a way to sort of keep myself grounded. I start every morning with some version of making beverages, making a big bowl of summer fruit with toasted seeds and coconut. Olive oil, a little bit of salt, maybe honeycomb if I'm feeling luxurious. And then I foam roll while I listen to Hot 97. Oh, Amanda's showing me a Shiro plum from across the room. Sexy, sexy fruit party time, any time of day. But this morning I listened to the Vince Staples album, Big Fish Theory, which is dope. I've been listening to Sid the Kid's album, which came out a few months ago, but that's really good. So that's what's sort of getting me going with my day. It's my way of taking care of myself.
Yeah. And you've been shopping at the Cult, a.k.a. Co-op.
I've been buying a lot of these things at the Co-op. Yes.
Yeah. It's the best place for that. Well, I kind of made my own version of that today, and that's why I brought out this beautiful plum. Honestly, don't want to get into this too much, but the fruit this season has been really inspiring. It's just so good. We hardly got any stone fruit last year, so...
I heard.
Yeah. So anyway, if you guys are by the Green Market, we are there every Saturday with different books and authors. So check out our website, foodbookfair.com. You can see our whole list of who we have coming up. Come through, buy a plum, get a book. And
it's not free. You gotta...
You
don't buy a plum and get a book.
You buy a plum and you buy a book by support, and you're going to support authors. If you come to the Green Market and say you heard this episode of Recommended Reading, I will buy you a plum.
We spend most of our time in the northwest corner of Union Square Park, directly across from Caradonna Farms, where they have a beautiful display of yellow Shiro plums that I spend 2 to 3 hours every Saturday morning looking at.
So come get one. We need to take a short break. Got to pay some bills around here. And, you know, we got to pay for our pizza, basically, amongst other things. So we will take a quick break. Definitely head over to heritageradionetwork.org. You want to click on that beating heart. Become a member. Support all of the incredible shows on air. And we will be back shortly with our guest, Joshua David Stein.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollock scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollock is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollock. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Yo, 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 Internet Radio. It's Kim and Amanda from Food Book Fair, and this is Recommended Reading today with Joshua David Stein, writer, editor, wearer of many hats. Hey, JDS.
Hey.
Welcome.
Thank you so much.
You wear so many hats. Would you mind introducing yourself in your own words and tell us what hats you're wearing these days?
I'll tell you my hats. I am, as Amanda said, the possessor of three names, Joshua David Stein, the father of two children, Kelly's and Augie, editor at large at Fatherly, which is a website devoted to modern parenthood and seeing the world through fatherhood, contributing editor at Food and Wine, and a contributor to many publications.
No.
Also author of Can I Eat That? Children's book for Fiden, Food and Beer, another cookbook from Fiden.
Not for children.
And the upcoming sequel to Can I Eat That? Called What's Cookin'?
Which will
be out in October.
Can't wait for that. Also, if you guys are lucky enough to be on Joshua's email list, you could receive emails with subject lines such as, let me stuff your stocking. And he means that. And he's going to stuff it with his books. Also, he is a musician.
Oh, true.
And a songwriter. So try to get on Joshua's email list so you can treat yourself to the inbox that you know you want. You know you want me
in your stocking.
Totally.
Do you get this? Is this like Christmas in July thing, or this is like a seasonal?
No, that was
she's referencing an old one, which is less creepy because it was around Christmas.
You haven't sent one for a while.
I know, it's because MailChimp charges per transmission. My list is too big.
So I just combed through what some of the ones you had sent for the best inbox.
Yeah. Yes, I have an album called Songs for Kids I've Had, which is songs about my kids, and also one called Forrester Sings Stein, which is my friend Kyle singing songs I've written because he's a better musician.
Cool.
And that's it, you know. I used to have a show on Heritage called the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour. As you know, the programs are half an hour. And my friend Kyle did the theme music for that song.
You had your own show?
Yeah, for 2 years.
Oh, my gosh.
It's true.
What haven't you done?
What haven't I done? Pilates?
Oh, we can fix that.
Yeah, I got to work on my power box.
I think you might work really hard on that, but you might not be able to achieve that.
What is that called? The area?
It's called your core.
It's called a box.
There's a box. Sometimes
David, can you Google that?
I haven't been in a Pilates class. in a minute, but
we should go to bar.
Guys, yeah. I just Googled box, and I have a surprise for you.
Right, I think.
Is it a startup based in Palo Alto, California?
You got it.
Yeah. Anyway, that's we're not here to talk about
that's a different
boxes.
Show.
Yeah.
No.
What would you like to talk about?
Let's talk about things you have done recently and timely.
Your article about the grill.
Where was it?
It was in the Village Voice.
Oh, yeah. It's true.
How did that piece come about? And how does, we would definitely want to get into that piece, but also when you write for different publications and outlets, is it a combination of maybe some editors approaching you, you always, pitching your ideas to them? And was the grill something you wanted to write about for a while?
Yeah, I wanted to write about the grill, and I'm grateful that I have a very good relationship with my editor at the Village Voice. And we had been talking about things I wanted to cover. I had written for them I had gone out for Italian food with Gay Talese a couple of months prior to this, and it was a really fun time.
I would love to hear about that.
Oh, it was great. It was in a French brasserie in the Upper East Side near where he lives on 61st Street, owned by one of Victor Hugo's descendants. It's called Maison Hugo, and it's actually an amazing restaurant. And Gay had a book coming out called High Notes, which is like a collection of essays. So I'd wanted to go to... So basically the idea I had pitched David a long time... David's my editor. A long time ago was I wanted to take... interesting people to interesting restaurants and then have them come and they would have something to do with the restaurant we were going to. Right.
Okay. There'd be some connection.
Yeah. So Gay Talese had High Notes coming out. Chumley's had recently reopened and I wanted to take him to Chumley's. Cause I figured he was probably around there and went in its prior iteration. Turns out Gay Talese hates Chumley's and like think, which I should have, thinking about him more, I should have realized he thought it was, back in the day when it was his speakeasy, it was needlessly exclusionary and he didn't like that aspect of it. So he didn't want to go there. Also, his wife, Nan, had hurt her knee, so he didn't want to leave his little like radius. Plus, he is a creature of habit and really only goes to like six restaurants on the Upper East Side. So he ended up going there. Anyway, it turned out really well. Everyone was really happy with the piece. And so I've kind of been mulling on.
You did go to Chumley's with
Gavin. No. We ended
Hugo.
Up going to Maison.
You went to Maison Hugo. Okay. Sorry, I just missed the last 2 minutes of that conversation. Anyway, continue. Sorry.
So now I'm kind of on this occasional beat where I'm trying to find interesting people to, interesting, relevant people to go to places and then situate the restaurant within the broader cultural and intellectual context.
So you found yourself at the Reworked Grill.
That's true.
At the Four Seasons, which is now run by the Hotshot Major Food Group. The guys that run Teresi, Carbone, Santina, among many others.
Yep.
And you talk about how today's power brokers, plutocrats, and masters of the universe can still enjoy their three martini lunches just like it was the 1950s in New York.
That is true.
But there are some nuances to that, aren't there?
Well,
beyond me reading the subhead to your story.
Yeah, but I think interestingly, the nuance, you know, would I like read that subhead again? The deck.
I'll read the whole thing.
No, just read the deck. What you just said about the.
In the old Four Seasons space, now run by the Hotshot Major Food Group team, today's power brokers, plutocrats, and masters of the universe can still enjoy their three martini lunches.
Right. So that's what I think is so interesting about the place. I know you and I kind of have a similar read on how we feel about that sentence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel very uncomfortable, and it's reflected in the piece that exists. And the whole piece is about exclusionary spaces and the danger and the cost of resurrecting them and of looking back so nostalgically at them. But I also think a lot of people can read that line and say, oh, great. Like, another, like, this is wonderful that they can still do this, and we're preserving some sort of history, and furthermore, we're preserving this power structure. So, you know, I think what I wanted to talk about in that piece is kind of how we can read the same factual, the same facts, the power brokers, plutocrats, and whatever other alliterative term can have their three martini lunches in the space. And to me, that seems abhorrent. And for many people as well, they think that's wonderful. And that more than likely, the people who think that it is wonderful are the people who enjoy that power and that privilege, right?
Whether they're conscious of it or not.
Yes, of course. I think probably, yes, exactly. Well said.
Just to give everyone a little bit more context before we discuss, let's talk about what the Four Seasons, you know, what the Four Seasons was. There was two rooms. It closed. The building itself got sold. It's called the Seagram Building now, right?
Yeah.
So
the Four Seasons in its original iteration, and still, it's a beautiful building. Mies van der Rohe did the outside, and Philip Johnson did
the restaurant. Yeah.
And they worked in tandem.
Okay.
And the restaurant, as far as spaces go, it's one of the only,
it's like the Watch the Throne of restaurant spaces, yeah. But like that?
Yeah.
It's actually and it's, good.
And it's beautiful, and it it's landmarked, so there's very little that could have been changed about the interior spaces.
Well, the interior is landmarked.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a pretty rare...
And you can see why.
No.
It is a wonderful example of modernism, you know? But anyway, yeah, it closed a couple of years ago after a long decline over for the latter part of which was presided over by two gentlemen, one of whom, Julian Nicolini, is an Italian maitre d', but what's the word? Sexual predator, who was, I think he pleaded to a lesser charge, but was accused of sexually harassing staff. Right?
Yes.
I only mention that, not in an ad hominem way, but to say that that general culture of sexism, I think, was pretty inherent, not only in the workplace culture, but also in the culture in general of the restaurant. The Grill of the Four Seasons had been, or the Four Seasons restaurant, as it was called, had catered to the wealthy, power brokers, plutocrats, all that, since its opening in... 50s, I believe, but it's in the piece in the mid-century.
Fact check that.
But had continued for some time to cater to that clientele, and it actually was the birthplace of the three martini lunch and all that came along with that three martini lunch, right? So it closed. It was sad. There was a lot of nostalgia around it. And the major, and A.B. Rosen, who's the landlord and also a partner in the restaurant, tapped Major Food Group to renovate it and reimagine it and reopen it, which they did. And they did it all extremely well. One of the things I say in the piece is the Major Food Group is extremely good at what they do. The meal I had there was from a purely... sensual experience, extremely pleasurable. Everything I ate, the texture of the menu, conceptually in its self-contained way, it was really enjoyable. The point I make in the piece is once you step outside of that room, metaphorically and physically, then you... see how that pleasure relates to the broader cultural context, political context, historical context. And that's when the pleasure really begins to sour, right? When you see that what is being celebrated is hardly food. The food is a performance. The entire experience is a performance. And what that performance is reenacting a exclusionary era, an era full of racism and misogyny and deeply unequal era. And it's accepting and celebrating that without asking a single question about the cost of creating a space like that. And people go there and they have this wonderful experience historically or ahistorically, or as we talked about, either they don't know and they probably don't care to know. Or to examine the implications of their enjoyment. And I think it's really, not to be shrill or alarmist or anything, but when you think about it, when you try to analyze the restaurant in a broader historical context, that is a dangerous thing. You know? I think for me, I write about food a lot. I've kind of become bored with evaluating food solely in solipsistic terms, solely in its own little bubble experience, especially when that bubble experience is delimited by pleasure. Like, did I have a good time or did I not have a good time? Was the veal well prepared? Was it not well prepared? How were the spice? You know, like, okay, great. There's many people who can do that, but that's not at all what I want to do, and it's not enjoyable. It's not interesting or enjoyable for me to experience it that way. You know, I think, I don't know, blah, blah, blah. That's what I think.
I mean, then are you talking about your philosophy or responsibility as a writer and someone who writes about food and engages in contemporary food conversation, or as a diner, or both?
I'm just one dude. Like, you know, like, as
you
I...
You have a platform and you have a voice.
Yeah, as I feel this way eating as yep. well. Yeah, of course. I feel it more as a... It sounds... I mean, whatever. I am... what's the word? Pompous? What's that
You're
word?
You're pompous?
Full of yourself? What is that word?
Oh. Pompous.
There's yeah, that works.
Arrogant?
Arrogant? Yeah, one of those. No, it's like when you put on airs. Like, to, you know, whatever. That
pretentious?
Word. Yes, pretentious.
There we go.
Thank you. people call me pretentious all the time, and I think to some extent, that's my friend Ling. Yeah. I am, right? But I do also think that it is a role of a critic not just to talk about pleasure. It's not like an art critic goes and says, is this painting pretty or is this painting not pretty, right? It's not like why would food be any different? Why is it just thought of in terms of pleasure in this narrow way? So I respond to it as a person and as a citizen and as a writer and as someone who is just in this world that and as someone who really loves food and restaurants, and I find it insulting, really, and dismissive that so much of restaurant criticism is about, is it good or is it bad? Like, that comprises a totality of the criticism. Like, why wouldn't you think of restaurants as part of the social fabric? It really is such an intense part, especially in New York, where it's been elevated to an art form. Evaluate it. Evaluate it like literature or like, you know, or, you know, modern or art or write about it. Why not? Like, there's no reason why not.
There is food criticism that does engage with social issues, political issues, or not even engage with social and political issues, but just acknowledges them.
Yeah,
and acknowledges that context. For example, I'm just thinking of Jonathan Gold's piece about Noma.
Which
does touch upon that, but it is rare.
Yeah.
Let's say.
Jonathan Gold, yes, he does do that. And I feel like there are some people, the writing that really goes hard at that is sort of ghettoized and not read by and large, right? Like those fall into this like weird policy death spiral.
Right.
What I try to do, and I think it's because I've transitioned from being more of a straight-ahead critic to this way, is try to do this, like, soft entry, almost, where it's like, come for the description of the food, stay for the social criticism, you know what I mean?
Love it.
So I think that's what I try to do in all of my writing. And I have to be honest, like, it's probably not right for a lot of places. I'm really fortunate that the voice... will tolerate that sort of movement, and as well as Food and Wine, who I write for, they've allowed me to kind of go in this direction.
Well, what I think is dope is that The Voice, which is known for progressive and radical history, is also so widely read and by so many different people. So I love Civil Eats, but not everyone who would pick this up and would read this on villagevoice.com would be finding the same story on civileads.com.
Yeah, and I will say there are people who do this so much better than I do on both sides, both on both on the straight food criticism and on the straight the more pure social justice critique. But I just, for whatever reason, have been given this sort of like platform where I can meld the two of them in a way that might get in front of a lot of people's eyes.
Are there any particular books that come to mind or other pieces that you would recommend reading, or is there other, you know, places that we can, you know, point to that can help us lay a foundation for kind of thinking about this in a little bit of a different way? We can, you know.
I mean, I will be honest.
Yes, that please
I don't find reading other food. I don't read that much food criticism or I don't read that much about food. That's not part of my media intake so much. I mean, yes, to understand what's going on and to see what's out there.
Right.
But I, what I get the most out of from an artistic standpoint are, you know, like, just totally unrelated to this, or policy, or like more nonfiction about other issues. What I always try to do is broaden the inputs from all over, from art and literature and all these things, which I don't get out of food writing, you know? So yes, I'm sure it's out there.
So what are you reading?
Yeah, or I was just thinking about what you wrote about The Last Magnificent, the Jeremiah Tower film that Kim and I had the privilege of seeing.
Yeah, it's, an alive movie. So what am I reading right now?
Yeah. Or what do you read when, or what kind of art informs your writing or your creative practice?
I would say right now, so right now I just moved.
Oh, okay.
So I don't have internet. At home, but I do have all these books that I brought out of storage.
That's
so I'm reading through some of those. The book that I read over and over again is a book called Eastern Approaches by Fitzroy MacLean. It was written in 1949. He was an amazing English sort of soldier. He fought in Africa, and then he also was embedded with the partisans in Yugoslavia, wow. And like. Hung out with Tito and all that stuff. That, like, I like that. I like his writing style.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading The Confessions of Dan Yak by a French guy named Blaise Cendrars, which is an amazing, like, absurdist-ish book. And what's the other thing I'm reading? Oh, and Lord Jim by Joseph Conrad, yeah. That's what I'm reading, and I'm listening to a lot of Nick Drake.
Nice.
I ran out of data on my phone, so I only have, like, four songs. And
are they all Nick Drake songs?
No, there's two that are Nick Drake, and then there's a Hall & Oates, and what's the fourth one? And there's some other one. Oh, and then the song I listen to over and over again, I checked the other day, I've listened to it 400 times, is this song by a group called The Beatles. And the song is called Blackbird, but this is a cover by this guy named Brad Meldow.
Yeah.
From, he was in a group called some shit. He was in another group. But it's like a jazz piano version.
Are you enjoying the being slightly off the grid at home?
Apart from being like surrounded by boxes, yeah. I mean, I just try not to, as you guys know as well, it's like you could just have your day occupied from when you wake up to when you go to sleep, taking in media, taking in things. And when do you have time to just let it all become a stew inside and, you know, and then come out in some way?
This is why I'm behind on Master of None and Insecure.
Yeah. Like, I also used to watch a lot of TV, and now that I feel like I outsource my emotions so easily to things that I see on television. I feel so deeply. I watched all Homeland, like, very, very, in a compressed amount of time. It's just, like, it's so much easier to feel for Claire Danes than it is for, like, the people in your life, so I'm trying to not squander my limited amounts of empathy. Whoa.
Yeah.
Any other?
Well, we have a minute or two to talk about.
You want to talk about Boite?
Yeah, I really want to talk about it.
Go ahead.
Go for it, Amanda.
Are there any like amazing stories that like from that have happened? If anyone doesn't know, what is would you call it a review?
What is like a short column for New York Times style section about bars and clubs.
Okay.
I've been doing what for a long time. Now, I'm not the exclusive guy. There's a lot of other people.
Right. But
Dietrich, I think, does a really good job.
He's a great what writer.
Yeah, he's
a great Boite writer.
He's really good. I've been doing it because I don't really go out, honestly, unless it's for work. Because I have a family. I have so many things going on that I don't really take the time to do that. And nightclubs and bars are not something I typically enjoy. But being there to be as a writer and it gives you this like shield to either be there alone and just watch what's going on. And in your own mind, you have an excuse as to why you're alone at a bar. Or
do you always have to go alone?
No. Sometimes I go with people, okay. But going with people, it's like, then I just want to eavesdrop and listen and, you know, talk to other people. So sometimes it's hard going with someone else. Or it allows you to go like all the way into the night, you know, like I am going to live this bar as hard as I can.
Like a sales force into the night.
Yeah. That's what I am for the New York Times style section. The intrepid, curmudgeonly bot guy.
Okay. Off the record and off air. We have a boite that we think you should go to.
Oh, you're fucking pitching me? Okay. Well, let's keep this on the air, David.
Safe space. No pitching here.
I said after.
Okay.
Let's maybe end with this question that I have. As someone who grew up here, it can sometimes feel like there's many people that are always saying, oh, New York, it wasn't what it used to. Like, you used to, you know, be able to go to the Chelsea Hotel and it was like this kind of party. You used to be able to go here and it was like this kind of party all night. And kind of the sentiment that New York is not fun anymore. Have there been any bots that have either made you agree with that or have been like, wow, no, New York's, you know, reinvigorated in a new way?
There are lots of fun places to go. I mean, yeah, probably New York has certainly changed a lot, and the rate of change is increasing. And some of the Village Voice actually had an amazing cover story with Jeremiah Moss from Vanishing New York.
I can't wait for his book
come
out.
And the cover story was great. And he talks a lot about this. But yeah, I mean, I think even Diamond Reef, where I just went on Atlantic Avenue, is really fun. I like that experience. And I went dancing at another place. Oh, I think it's called Mezcaleria Milagrosa.
I remember that piece.
That was a wild time, right? Like, okay. It was just wild. And I liked it.
Awesome. I would love to hear you apply what you talk about in terms of relative pleasure and absolute pleasure. And you speak on it so eloquently in your Village Voice piece about Major Food Group and the Four Seasons Grill. Tu bois. And going out, if we have time, which we might not.
I think what I would say about this, and just for, you know, anyone who thinks this language sounds familiar, absolute pleasure and relative pleasure is analog with the Buddhist tradition of absolute truth and relative truth. So I am very aware of those parallels, and that's kind of my understanding of why I'm applying it here. This also sounds familiar, that, like, there's a sane and a neurotic way to go out, and there's a sane and neurotic kind of bar space or nightclub or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have someone dancing wildly on the dance floor. That could be sane or it could be neurotic. It could be healthy or not, you know, unhealthy, I guess you could say. And it's what they're doing themselves with that action is nothing. It's neither here nor there, right? It's not good. It's not bad. It's how they're relating to that. Are they running away from something? You know, are they refusing to work through something? Are they causing harm to other people? All these questions, right? Maybe the answer is yes, and maybe that's unhealthy. Are they just having a fun time and they're in the moment? You know, maybe that's the case. I think that, you know, in any given bar, right, you have all of those interactions going on, and I haven't really come across it that much, but you know, I think you might have in your mind that place, what is it called, Summer Hill.
Ooh.
With the bullet holes, and that I think it's in
Crown Heights.
Crown Heights.
I passed by it in a car the other day.
Yeah. So
there were two white people sitting in there.
Right. So basically for the listeners, there's this bar in Crown Heights, and the woman who is white kind of fetishized these holes in her wall, which she said were bullet holes, and she kind of used that as a selling point.
She was serving rosé.
In a 40-ounce
bottle and paper bags.
So that is probably a more direct analog to something like the Fort Grill, right, at the Four Seasons.
Though it is fetishizing black culture and the more infamous histories of that neighborhood.
Sure. So it's kind of like,
black psychic trauma.
Yeah, exactly. In that little room, like those two white people you passed by, they might have been like, this rosé is great. And, you know, the prices are good. And like,
it's
whatever.
A 40-ounce bottle.
Yeah, right. So that is that's relative pleasure. And then when you look out, then that when you see how inappropriate it is, that would kind of lead you to the conclusion that in absolute terms, it's not pleasurable. It's a non-virtuous action that you're indulging in.
I can't wait to see how these businesses continue to evolve and serve their clientele.
And you know what? Maybe that will be something that she learns from, and it will, you know, maybe there is some good to be found in it. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it's good that even if the place closes, that conversation has happened, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I mean, generally, that's a terrible, terrible fucking thing to happen.
Well, I think we have to leave it at that today.
Okay.
Maybe we'll see you at Diamond Reef.
Could do. Bye.
We can combine the serious dancing with serious conversation.
Yes. Yeah. Anytime.
Sounds like a radio show.
Thanks, JDS.
Thank you so much. You can find Joshua on his social handles at Fake Josh Stein.
That's right.
So he posts all of his latest and greatest there. So please do check him out. And thank you for joining us on Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Recommended Reading is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.